Okay, so we have a lot about side channel attacks, and this type of side channel attacks include also fault injections. So this presentation is focusing on one type of protection against this type of attacks, and although it's as the title says, we are looking at symmetric key cipher. The same technique applies for public key encryptions, and we have done some work, and some other people have published paper on the same type of approach. So this, before I start, let me mention that this work has been done with collaboration with Luca Bavuglieri, that is sitting right here, and with Paolo Maestri and Guido Bertoni, who did part of this work as did some of this work as part of the PhD research. Okay, so let's start with the outline. I'll start with the introduction, mainly motivation, although you are highly motivated by now, listening to all the lectures that you had before. And I'll take as an example for this approach the AES encryption algorithm. It's a simple example and a very relevant example. And to be even more specific, I will start with the parity code, the simple parity code example. I'll show how error propagates and what type of fault coverage you can get if you use a parity code. We will then see an example, how would you modify an existing implementation of AES to include fault detection. We'll see what type of penalty you have to pay in terms of area and latency. And we'll also touch upon fault location, how it can be done, and why would we do that. And then we'll extend it a little bit further to show how this approach applies to other symmetric block ciphers, what are the basic operations that other ciphers besides AES do include, what type of error correcting code we can consider for those, what is the frequency at which we have to check whether we already have an error, and then what type of detection coverage. And it should be clear that we cannot expect, whatever error correcting code we use, we cannot expect 100% detection. That's impossible theoretically. But we would like to get as close as possible, and we will finish with some conclusions. Okay, so let's start with a very brief introduction. Why do we need to protect against faults? First of all, it's sort of the generic type of motivation. We need high reliability. As we heard the other day in Christoph's presentation, the complexity, the number of gates that we need for implementing some of those ciphers is very large, which means that it's very likely that something will go wrong, some soft error will hit the circuit, and so we might get an erroneous result. So we would like to detect those to avoid transmission of erroneous messages. But more importantly, at least for this workshop, is that faults can be maliciously injected by an attacker that wishes to extract the secret key out of our circuit. So and fault attacks, such deliberate fault injections, is a very efficient technique that they can retrieve the secret key with a very small number of experiments. So we don't need to run through all the possible keys like we've seen for tests and so on. There's no need. You run a few tens of those experiments with fault injection and you have the secret key right there. Much simpler. And such attacks have been not only described theoretically, some of them have been implemented in practice against most of the well-known ciphers like AES, TES, RC4, RSA, and ECC, and so on. So one would think that maybe we can use the traditional fault detection techniques that are based on redundancy, but those turn out to be either too expensive or too slow or both. And let's see a couple of those in the next slide. So we can start with generic duplication, and duplication can be in two forms. First, hardware duplication, where you duplicate the cipher circuit twice, and you then do a comparison. And if they don't, they're not equal, you say something went wrong, I don't want to continue with this operation. and it relies on the assumption that if attacker injects a fault, it's unlikely that he or she will be capable of injecting exactly the same fault in the two copies. So those two copies will have different outputs, and we will then detect it immediately. Another way of duplication is, instead of spatial redundancy, we can have time redundancy, where we repeat the calculation on the same hardware, and again, the underlying assumption that it's unlikely the attacker would be able to inject exactly the same fault in those two different separate in time executions. Another approach is to exploit unused hardware. And this is, if you have in your circuit two units, one for encryption, one for decryption, and while doing the decryption, you don't use encryption and vice versa, you can use the other one. So you encrypt the message, and before sending it out, you go run it through the decryption. If you go back to the plain text, it means everything is fine, and you can go ahead and send the ciphertext. Another variation of more traditional approach is to exploit idle cycle time, especially if you have pipelined implementation. Then you can run the second, the duplicated processing, you can run immediately after that, and with the pipeline implementation, the redundancy is a penalty in terms of time would be much smaller than otherwise. Why are we looking here at error detecting codes? Because most of them will offer a much smaller hardware and time overhead than the brute force duplication. And as we know, in many applications, cost is extremely important, so we don't like the idea of doubling or tripling the cost of our unit. And what will be involved, what will be the hardware overhead that we'll need for error detecting code? We'll need a code, a circuit that will generate the code, a comparator that will validate the correctness of the code, and prediction circuit, as we'll see in a minute. We will focus here on separable codes in which the definition is that the check bits are totally separate from the data bits. So this simplifies greatly the generation of the check bits and the prediction and the checking of them. If they are non-separable codes, the overhead in terms of time and area are much bigger. And the two best, the two most well-known separable codes are the parity codes and the residue codes. Parity codes, the main disadvantage that they don't treat very well even order type of faults, and we'll go in detail over this later on, but they allow various granularities. You can have parity for 32 bits, for 8 bits, for 4 bits, so you have quite flexibilities. Residue codes, the disadvantage that you cannot start with a single check bit, you need at least two. But on the other hand, they deal with other even order faults in the same way, so you don't have the problem, the disadvantage of the parity. And there are some other specialized codes that can be used as well. Most of them, however, are non-separable, which means they have high overhead, and we will not touch on those in this discussion. So as I mentioned before, our example will be AES, so just to remind you what AES is all about. We have 128-bit data output input, and the output as well, as the secret key can be anywhere between 128 to 256, and it's a ARM-based type of block cipher, so we have those four basic operations, sub-bytes, shift-row, mixed column, and end-round key, which is shown right here, and the round key is generated by a separate key schedule here that also has the same number of rounds and is based on the same type of basic operations, so as a result, we don't show them right here. And this is sort of a slightly more detailed diagram. We see here the four basic operations that are repeated in the middle round, but it turns out that the first initial round includes only the addition of the round key, and the last round doesn't have that mix call. But in principle, if we will find a way to protect those against injected fault, we will have a solution for the entire circuit. Okay, so the 128-bit data block in AES is organized as a 4x4 matrix where the entries are bytes, and this is called the state matrix, and this would be the basis for us to decide how many parity bits or other residue check bits should we add. So the check bits will be associated with the state, with the byte of the state matrix, and will be updated after each internal transformation. So that's a generic type of diagram that will follow. We have the input, the data input, or the, we'll call it the input state matrix, that undergoes one of the transformations that we've seen before in each round. And so we generate an output state matrix. In parallel, we have a set of check bits. And here you can see the separation between the check bits and the data bits. So the check bits will undergo a prediction that will be the corresponding prediction to this particular transformation, and it will generate a set of predicted check bits. At this point, what we can do, we can regenerate the check bits from this output state matrix and compare it to the predicted ones. If there's any discrepancy between those, we know that somebody or some fault has happened during this transformation. Some attack here, for example, injected a fault. As a result, we may then do something about it. What can we do about this? One extreme solution might be to clear the storage for the secret key and basically disable the entire circuit. This might be maybe an extreme one. Another possibility might be that we will generate a random number and output it. This will hopefully totally confuse the attacker because he won't have the nice correspondence between the plain text and what we see is what he gets its output. Okay, so this is just a diagram to better clarify the checkpoint verification. Here we have the input bit, so we have the generator, the initial generator, and then the input text goes through one or more of those transformations. And in parallel, the check bits go through one or more of those predictors corresponding to those operations. And at any point, either after one operation or after a sequence of operation, we regenerate the check bits and then compare it to the predicted one. And the discrepancy will indicate that there's an error. Please stop me if you have any questions at any point. Okay, so now let's focus on parity code in AES. Let's associate a single parity bit with each byte of the state, so we'll end up with 16 parity bits corresponding to those 16 bytes elements of the 4x4 state matrix. And we will have a similar type of diagram. The only difference is that now we have, instead of the generic check bits, we have parity bits that are going through this parity prediction. So the most difficult part of this is the design of the parity prediction. Everything else, the generation and the checking, are straightforward type of circuits that most of you have seen in basic digital design type of classes. But before we do look at those prediction rules, let's slightly extend our model to allow also fault injected in the key schedule type of process. So in order to do that, what we'll do, we will use the same idea. Let's add a parity bit to each byte of the key matrix. So if we started with a 4x4 matrix for the state, for the data, or the plain text and eventually the cipher text, we will add a 4x4 key material, we will add a parity bit to each one of the element bytes here and a parity bit to each one of those. So we will, this will allow us to protect even the key schedule process against such injected faults. Okay, so what are the prediction rules that we need to use? It turns out that for 3 out of the 4 transformations, those prediction rules are trivial. If you start with subbyte, which is normally implemented as an S-box, as a lookup table, then you simply need to store the parity bits together with the output, with the data in those tables. If you have the shift-out transformation, you simply have to rotate the parity bit, because the shift rows rotate bytes, so the parity bit simply follows the bytes wherever they go. If you have the end-round key, that's trivial, because if you have a parity bit for the byte of the data and for a parity bit for the corresponding byte of the key, you simply do XOR of those two parity bits, and you know what's a parity bit that you expect. The only non-trivial part is the mix column, but we were able to come up with an equation that will do this prediction. So the parity bit, the predicted parity bit of the after transformation is calculated from the parity bits of the input plus a couple of bits from the data. So that's a relatively simple and easy to implement type of prediction circuit. Okay, one question that we still need to decide on is how often do we check? It means how often do we regenerate the parity bits and compare it to the predicted one in order to detect faults? So if one extreme is to do the checking after every transformation. But this means that this will have a very high overhead in terms of execution time and also in terms of circuitry. The other extreme is to do it once after you are done with the encryption. But the problem with this, it might be that the fault indication would be masked, and even though there was a fault by the time you get there, the limited capability of the parity bit would be such that you will have no remaining indications that anything went wrong. And something in between is after every run. We would like, for the purpose of simplified implementation and lower overhead, to use the encryption level. The question is whether this is a possible implementation. So for that purpose, we really need to see how the error propagates through the circuit. So we will represent this as a matrix, and this error state matrix is just the XOR operation between all the predicted parity bits and the parity bits that might be generated at every point. So this is a real parity of the data that as it goes through one transformation to the other. So if a single element, single entry in this matrix, ERC, if this is equal to 1, this will say that the byte in this row, in this column, is incorrect due to some injected fault. If it is, however, if it's 0, we would like to always claim that this is, means that no fault has been injected. Unfortunately, because of the limited capabilities of the parity bit, we may have a situation that this was an even order fault within the same byte, which the parity is unable to detect. Okay, so let's take an example. Suppose we have a single transient fault that we injected in byte 0. So the error matrix will have a single 1 here and zeros in all other places. So now we take this and go through the entire set of transformation and see what happens to this error matrix. As you can see, the number of 1s increases, but it turns out that after 8 rounds, we go back to the original matrix. But however, we never go back to all zeros. So the indication of an error doesn't disappear, and we will see later on what exactly do we do with this type of situation that we go back to the original error matrix. if we have such a matrix E for the transformations, what we can for after each transformation, we can then now look at the entire set of transformations and see what type of changes will be made to the arrow indication once it goes through all the transformations. And it turns out that because of the linearity, that we end up with a single matrix Z that is shown right here, so that after every round, you get you have to multiply the previous error matrix by this Z in order to get the new matrix. So that's a very simple type of representation that allows you to calculate the error matrix after a number of transformations. So in general, after n rounds, you have to raise this Z to the power of n and know exactly what error indication you will end up after n rounds. This, it turns out that this particular matrix Z clearly depends on the outer operation, so this is particular to AES, and you have to recalculate it if you use another cipher. But and the error can be detected in principle as long as this is not the E doesn't completely become all zeros. Since this matrix capital Z, it turns out to be orthogonal, it never completely cancels the error, which means that on the basis of those statements, we can conclude that we can wait until the end of the encryption and only then do the checking of the parity bits. There's no risk that the error indication will disappear during the computation. Okay, if we would like to extend, as we mentioned before, our protection against error injected in the key schedule as well, what we can do is to extend the model for the key schedule as shown here. As it turns out, if this is the error matrix for the key schedule, the subscript K stands for the key schedule, then we have a similar type of linear relationships. The matrix is different from the matrix that we've seen before, but it's a similar behavior. So as a result, if you put the two together, you get that the error matrix after R plus one rounds will be the previous relationship that we've seen before, but you have to add the possible errors in the key schedule as well. And the addition here is simply because the last step, last transformation, is simply adding the round key, so that's a modulo 2 type of addition. Okay, now if you look at now this matrix ZK, it doesn't have exactly the same nice property as we had for the Z before. It is non-singular, but only Z to the power 15 in an orthogonal. And if you raise it to the power 60, then you go to the identity matrix, which means that you may lose your L indication. Fortunately, AES doesn't go that far. It goes only to 14 iterations, so we don't get to this risk. Okay, what is the error coverage that we get here? So first of all, we have concluded that we can, it's enough to have a single checkpoint scheduled at the end of the encryption. So we don't need any checking to be done every round or every transformation. It can be shown, and we've shown analytically, that all single faults are detected. So that's established. For multiple fault coverage, it's too difficult to do it analytically, so we have done a large number of simulations by injecting faults randomly. And what we've seen, and let's focus in particular double fault, this is sort of the most difficult type of fault for parity-based codes. If those are not detected, if two faults affect the same byte simultaneously, exactly the same transformation, we get exactly two faults, then this particular parity bit will be incapable of detecting. There's a sort of another unique type of situation because of what we've seen before, that two other faults can, if they hit the same byte, but are separated exactly by a distance of 8 rounds, because after 8 rounds, the error matrix goes back to the original value. So if you have this situation, it's equivalent to two errors happening at exactly the same time. So again, you have an undetected. But that's somewhat unlikely to be to happen. The attacker will not be able to do it. It will be very difficult to do it this way. However, if you look at the total coverage of double faults, so double faults don't have to be necessarily in the same byte. It can be all over the place. So if you do the calculation and you assume that those faults can be, double faults can be injected in a uniform type of distribution, then you get this very high fault coverage. And let's look at the sort of the summary of the results that we have here. So that's the percentage of undetected faults, and that's the total number of injected faults. So you can see the worst case is for the double faults. For one, it's zero, so we don't even show it, because it can be proved, it has been proved that it's the probability of undetected fault is zero. But even here, it's below 0.1%, and then it goes drastically down for a higher number of injected faults. Now, the whole idea will work because of our belief that it's the attacker will be unable to inject exactly two faults in exactly the same byte. With all the precision that he can get nowadays with laser beams, it will be very difficult with the current technology of CMOS to, and the current feature size, to hit exactly two bits and no more and no less. So the likelihood of this to be undetected is very low, but it's still not zero. So as I was saying before, you cannot guarantee 100% detection. Okay, let's see an example. How would you implement, and the bottom line is to see how much do you have to pay for this. So we will start with the reference architecture that will be sort of a plain vanilla type of architecture. You don't have any hoop unrolling, so you implement the four transformations and then you iterate through those, through the number of rounds that you need. So, and you don't have pipelining, and it's encryption only, so you don't have a decryption unity. And it's a full parallel type implementation, so you have a data pass of the 128-bit wide, and this means that you will end up with 16 S boxes, each for one of the 16 bytes that you have, and you will do all mixed columns in parallel as well. Okay, so how would you then extend it to include the 30 prediction circuit? You will have a parallel data path that will include the prediction circuits for the individual unit. So, and again, you can see, easily see the nice property of separability. This will be a data path totally separate from the other one. The only place where they get together is when you have a checkpoint to verify the correctness of the predicted charity bits that you've accumulated so far. Okay, so why do we have, what type of overhead can we expect? We can expect overhead in terms of area because we have a check bit circuit for check bit prediction. We need code generators at the very beginning, and we need comparators at the very end to check for errors. What type of latency penalty can we expect? We have an initial code generation. We cannot start before we have the initial check bits, and we need to allow time for the final validation. We don't want to send the message out before we know to output the message before we know that there's no errors, because otherwise the attacker will have use the information either way. So, and we are definitely more concerned with the higher latency than with the larger area. Transistors are cheap nowadays, but performance is expensive. Okay, so let's see what type of results did we get. We did the two implementations, two designs, depending on the particulars of the S-box. And what we show here is the area, the latency, and the product of those. And so the top line is the base architecture with no parity error prediction whatsoever. The second line is how those area and the latency go up with after adding the error detection. And in red, you see the increase in area and in latency. So that's the, as I was saying before, the error increase is acceptable. Nobody will make a big fuss of this, but this might be too much. Okay, so let's see. So one of the lessons that we have seen from this one that it's relatively easy to take an existing design and modify it to include error detection, mainly because of the separability. It's a separate circuit, so it's very easy to add this. Every designer can do it in a very short time. And to summarize what we've seen before, error overhead is a range of 15 to 16, but the latency is too high. So why do we have such a high latency, or what can we do about the high latency? We can move the comparator out of the critical path, and maybe the best way to do it is by pipelining, and then you can reduce the effect of this additional latency. But you'll have some if you want to make sure that the incorrect output will never be seen by the attacker. Okay, let's move on to what, as I mentioned before, fault location. And before we look at the details, why would anybody be interested in locating the fault? If the purpose is to protect against attacks, we simply want to detect it and shut the device off and not do anything else. So first of all, if we are concerned about reliability, and then we might have a circuit that has a redundant byte slice, and then this redundant byte slice will connect, we will connect it upon locating a permanently fault byte slice. So this is just for the purpose of reliability. If we don't want to replace a chip right away, this will extend the lifetime of the chip. But it might even provide better protection against fault injection attacks. And this is still sort of a bit fuzzy, but let me tell you one scenario. We know that byte parity is unable to detect all injected errors, especially the double or even order type of faults. So if we have an attacker that tries to inject those types of errors, we may provide it enough information to get the key secret key up. Hopefully, at least one of his experiment will be such that it would be an odd number. And if we catch it, and then we will disconnect this byte slice and move its functionality to the redundant byte slice, then the attacker, chances are, we will not know what we have done and will keep attacking this byte slice that is no longer in use. And so we will be then be better protected against those type of attacks. That's one scenario, and you can come up with some other scenarios, but it sounds like it's a good idea if we can do location and do something about the faulty part of the circuit. So how can we do location if we have a byte parity scheme as we've seen before? First of all, we have to keep in mind that after 8 rounds, the error state goes back to the initial value, which means that we lose the, if we do any attempt to locate the fault, we must do it within 8 rounds, otherwise we lose this information about the exact timing and the exact location. So for it turns out that for each single transient fault, and we'll use the acronym STF for this in a byte, the error state matrix, the type of the type that we've seen before, is unique as long as we stay within those eight rounds. So this means that if you have two different errors, you will get two different state matrices. As a result, it's a one-to-one correspondence, and if you look at the error matrix, you can then go back and know exactly what fault was injected, which byte, and exactly at which round. So, and this going back from the state matrix to the fault can be done either you prepare ahead of time lookup table, or you simply continue multiplying by the inverse matrix of Z until you get a matrix that has a single one, and then you know this is the error and this is the time when it was injected. So let's take an example. If we observe this type of error matrix, we can keep on multiplying by Z to the minus one, by the inverse of Z, until we get a matrix with a single one, then we know that the error was injected in byte zero and during that round that for which this corresponds to. Or, as we were saying, with a table lookup, we can write down a table of this type that has the 16 different bytes from 0 to 15 and has the 8 rounds. We are limited to 8 rounds. We should do it within the 8 rounds. And it turns out that each of the entries here is unique. So we have the one-to-one correspondence. So by looking at this table, we know exactly when and where was this fault injected. So it looks beautiful for a single intermittent fault, which is the type of fault that the attacker will inject. But if we are concerned about reliability as well, let's see what happens if we have a permanent fault. And a permanent fault is a fault that will affect always exactly the same bit. So you can say it's an intermittent fault that reoccurs again and again. Now, depending on the input and the key, this particular fault can manifest itself in any number of rounds out of the eight. Basically, if you look at the stuck at one fault, if the original bit was one, the stuck at one fault will have no effect whatsoever. If it's the original bit supposed to be zero, then the stuck at one fault will turn it into one. So, which means that the manifestation of the error will change from one round to the other depending on the original value of the data bit. So in this case, we don't have this nice mathematical type of description. You don't have a matrix that you can multiply by its inverse in order to get to identify the permanent fault, but you can use lookup table, and let's see how those look like. So this would be the this is a signature matrix. Those are the type of signatures that each fault will generate. And what we have here is, first of all, we have the 16 different bytes, depending on the exact location of the fault. But here we have the different manifestations of the fault, where 0-1 means it has been manifested only in the first round, while FF means it has been manifested in all eight rounds, which is not very likely because this bit will change from 0 to 1. So that's theoretically it's there, but practically chances are you'll never get to this point. So the question is whether here we still have the one-to-one correspondence as we had before. Can we read off one of those and know exactly when and what byte was hit by that fault? So overall, this matrix consists of 4,080 values. Unfortunately, only 3,072 are unique. The other ones are duplicates or replicates. So for example, you can see that this value appears twice, this value appears twice, and in the last row, the unlikely type of row, you have many replicates. So This means that this might, the conclusion might be that we cannot do any fault location, but it's not terribly bad. You can run a second, you can have a second run, and it's unlikely that you will get exactly the same situation, so it's enough that you'll hit once this situation of a unique signature, and once you have a unique signature, you know exactly where the permanent fault happened, and you can then, if you have redundancy, you can then disconnect this faulty part of the circuit and use the redundant part instead. Okay, I think I'll skip this part and briefly go to the extension to other symmetric block cipher, and I'll try to do it very quickly. Okay, so the idea is to see how this will work for other block ciphers, and the point is that they use different basic operations. For example, in DES, in DES we use bit-oriented operation, or in a cipher-like idea, we use modular arithmetic with some crazy modulus. So we would like eventually to give guidelines how to use the best error detecting code given a cipher that you plan to use. And also suggest what type of generality, how many check bits should you use, and where to place those check bits. And finally, they determine the checkpoint frequency. Do you have to check after each transformation, after each round, or you can wait until the end of encryption, and know what type of, what do you get in return, what is the detection coverage. So we looked at the type of operation of large number of representative types of block ciphers, and those are shown right here. So all of them are used basic SOR operation. Some, quite a few use a basic binary addition. Several use multiplication, SBOX, you can see rotation, permutation, modular operations. So you have a large family of different operations, and all of them need to be considered when you look at the EDC, because you need prediction rules for each one of those operations. Without prediction rules, you cannot get anything. So if we look at the set of those operations, and we again limit ourselves to the parity in residue code, you can see the yes here means it's done at a reasonable price. The prediction is doable at a reasonable price. Expensive means that it's, the circuit will be so complicated that you are better off duplicating this particular transformation rather than doing any sophisticated error correcting code. So that's the meaning of the expensive portion here. Okay, so after you summarize, after you list all the operations and find the best EDC for each one of the operations, you can then put them together and come up with suggested codes for the individual ciphers. For example, for this, the previous tables conclude that parity will do the best. For IDEA, you can use residue, but it will be expensive. So that's an example of a type of consideration you might do before selecting a side block cipher. If you are concerned about fault injection, maybe you shouldn't use those two unless you are willing to pay heavily in terms of protection against fault injections, if that's a concern. Okay, for RC5, you can use either one of them with about the same overhead. For RC6, only the residue will work well. And for those two, parity per byte will give you the highest coverage at a reasonable type of cost. And maybe a couple of results here. What we have here is, for example, RC5 with parity code, and we look at four different implementations. You can either do the parity at the level of one per word or one per byte, and you can do the checking either at the end of the encryption or after each round. And you expect that after each round you'll get better coverage at end round, end check. And similarly, the byte should, the parity will give you better coverage than a word parity. And we can see it right here, that's as before, the percentage of undetected faults. If you do the word parity and check, you get a very poor coverage. If you move then to byte parity and then check, you improve the situation drastically. You're now lower than 1%. And if you use the round per round type of checks, you improve it even further. You go to a very small tenths or one thousandth of a percent of undetected faults. So that's the type of experiment that you can do in order to see what type of benefits do you get from the various error detecting codes. That's the same one, but with residue. Again, you have several possibilities. Use residue 3 with 2 check bits, or residue 15 with 4 check bits. And again, either you do it at the end or after each round. And you see a similar situation, but now notice that if you use the residue 15 at every round, you really get a very nice close to zero type of undetected fault. So that's definitely much better than before, but you have to pay for it more because you have now 4 check bits and you have to check every round. So there's always a trade-off between the penalty and what you get as fault coverage. Okay, I think since those slides will be eventually available on the website, if one of the organizers will show up anytime soon, then we can go directly to the conclusions. And what we have shown here is that such error-detecting codes are appropriate for a wide range of cryptographic operations, and they cover logical, arithmetic, and modular operation. We didn't cover end and all. It turns out the source duplication would be the easiest, the least expensive type of solution. We've shown that you have many degrees of freedom, so you can do nicely the trade-off between cost and benefits. So you can select the type of code, the frequency of checkpoint, and the number of check bits, and some possible future directions if you are interested. Then you can analyze some other error detection codes, and there are quite a few, either old ones or new ones that have been suggested for particular for this type of side channel attacks. And at some point, it would be nice to develop a library of functional units with concurrent error detection, so that designers that are not really experts in error detecting codes can be use them. And then maybe reconfigurable fault tolerant designs can be also developed for reasons that we've seen before. And I'll stop with that.